This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. Merry Christmas. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin is off this week. President Trump is celebrating Christmas with his family in Florida. On Christmas Eve, the president spoke to U.S. troops stationed overseas. British Prime Minister Theresa May also paid tribute to her country's armed forces in her Christmas message.
This Christmas, as people across the United Kingdom celebrate this special time of year with their families and friends, we will do so secure in the knowledge that the valiant hearts of our servicemen and women, many far away from their own loved ones at this special time of year, are working to keep us safe.
She made no reference to the issue that dominated her year. That would be Brexit. And joining us now to talk about that is Rob Watson, BBC political correspondent. He's in London. Rob, Merry Christmas.
And season's greetings to you, Jeremy, and to everybody listening, of course.
Of course. And tell us, first of all, where we are with Brexit at this point. We've talked to you so many times this year, but what's happening?
Oh, my goodness. Where are we with Brexit? Well, Britain has got through stage one, which was to figure out how does it get out, the divorce agreement, if you like, and that's going to involve paying vast amounts of money. Not that that was mentioned during the referendum campaign, but never mind. We could come back to that later. It involves some promises on how we're going to manage the border between the Irish Republic, which is staying inside the European Union, and Northern Ireland, which is not. And then thirdly, an agreement about what happens to the 3 million or so EU nationals living in this country. So guess what? This is the easy bit. This has been really tricky. The really difficult bit comes, and that is trying to decide Britain's future relationship with the European Union. I say difficult because we haven't tried anything like this before, and because, of course, the governing Conservative Party, led by Theresa May, is hopelessly, deeply, and poisonously divided over it.
Well, let's talk about Theresa May.
Let's.
What's this year been like for her?
I guess the word that comes to mind is extraordinary, and one that in normal times would have seen her or anybody out like her booted out of office. I mean, if I could go through the charge sheet, Jeremy, if I could put it that way. I mean, you think about it. In March, she triggered what's known as Article 50. That's the process for leaving the European Union over a two-year period. She activated it without seeming to have any idea of what it was that Britain wanted to achieve. A few months later, she then called a snap election, hoping to improve her majority to boost it. In fact, she lost seats. She's lost three government ministers. Living standards are down in the UK. Inflation is up. And you have the opinion polls showing very little faith in her to handle that most important of all issues, the one we've just been discussing, Brexit. So why is she still there, Jeremy? Because the Conservatives can't agree on anybody better. And because the opposition Labour Party, led by the very left-wing Jeremy Corbyn, isn't providing very much, well, guess what, opposition.
Well, speaking of Jeremy Corbyn, that takes us to a piece of tape that I want to play. One of the most fun things about British politics is the Prime Minister's question time, when the Prime Minister has to go every week before the House of Commons and take questions. And let's listen to what happened last week. This is with the Member of Parliament, Clive Effort.
Last year, the Prime Minister told the Radio Times that on Christmas Day, she likes to prepare and cook her own goose.
You know what's coming.
In the spirit of Christmas, can I suggest to her that in order to extract the maximum pleasure from the messy job of stuffing her goose, that she names it either Michael or Boris?
Can I say to the Honourable Gentleman, I think I'll be having to resist the temptation to call the goose Jeremy.
Yeah! Okay, and she's not talking about me, she's talking about Jeremy Corbyn. But put that into context for American listeners.
Right, so okay, so the question was posed by a member of the opposition Labour Party, an MP, and the references were to Michael Gove, who's a senior government minister, and Boris Johnson, who is Britain's foreign minister. Both of them were very senior in the campaign to leave the European Union, and both are seen very much as a powerful players and extremely controversial figures. And yes, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition Labour Party.
Did he gain ground in the last year?
He did, and I think everyone thought, with his hard left views, and let's remember, this is why Theresa May called the election. She thought, crikey, you couldn't possibly lose against someone that left-wing. I mean, no one alive in Britain today can ever remember a leader of a major party as left-wing as Jeremy Corbyn is. But amazingly, in the snap election, that Theresa May called in June, he did rather well. And I think that's partly because an awful lot of young people can't remember the Cold War, they can't remember communism, they can't remember the troubles in Northern Ireland, the IRA. So if you like, he got a bit of a pass. But to bring us right up to date, I mean, his progress has sort of stalled since that snap election in June. And I think most people would say that under his leadership, the Labour Party has really provided very little in the way of opposition, which in the way Britain's parliamentary democracy works, and you've got a flavour of it there, that questioning, that sort of cut and thrust, he's really not been very effective.
Rob, as we look forward to next year, one of the questions is whether Theresa May is going to host President Trump and the Queen, by the way, host President Trump on a state visit in the UK, something that's been very controversial so far.
Well, I sure as heck haven't got my invite yet, so so I don't really know. I mean, I did hear a Conservative MP after this business of the president retweeting some video put out by this really far-right anti-Muslim group in the UK, that one Conservative MP said, you know, yes, that visit of Donald Trump to the United Kingdom, I don't think that either Downing Street or Buckingham Palace are exactly rushing to find their diaries. I mean, I think he's got a point. I think it would all be incredibly awkward for Downing Street and a bit less so for Buckingham Palace and for the Queen. But it seems to me that once you've invited someone, it's going to be quite tricky to get out of it.
I guess we're going to have to wait a while for The Crown, the TV show The Crown, to get to the point of this, what's happening now. But I can't wait. BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. Rob, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Well, now to Reno, Nevada, where three casinos made moves this year to attract and retain employees. Not by doing what some companies do, allowing people to work remotely or adding cafes or games in the workplace. The casinos added on-site health clinics for their workers. On Gray of Reno Public Radio reports.
On the floor of the Circus Circus Casino, dozens of workers deal cards and carry drink trays to gamblers. Amid the beeps and chimes of slot machines, their aim is to cater to the whim of guests from all over the world. But if they need a checkup, these employees don't have to go far for medical attention. Right around the corner is their workplace clinic. Sergio Gonzalez walks into the clinic lobby. He's a security guard with Circus Circus and is here to find out if he can see someone for back pain. He's relieved to get an appointment for later that day.
Chances are I'd be less likely to want to seek treatment considering that I haven't really had access to care as easily.
There's no copay or limit on how many times workers or their eligible family members can come for care. Gonzalez says having this benefit makes him want to stay with the company.
It's accommodating for employees to be able to have an on-site clinic to refer to if they had medical emergencies or medical necessities. Convenience and accessibility are two aspects that are absolutely beneficial as an employee.
This model, which I do believe is going to be a model of the future, it saves money for not only employers, but also for patients.
Corey Singleton has been a primary care physician for about two decades and now works at the casino clinic. She says there are long-term benefits to removing barriers to health care.
If I can't afford to go to my doctor frequently to try to get my diabetes under control, I may not go and therefore may not get the care that I need in the long run. That costs me more money, costs the employer more money, it costs the healthcare system in general more money.
The nonprofit Integrated Benefits Institute estimates that sick days and poor health cost the U.S. economy more than $500 billion each year. And on-site clinics do help employers cut costs, says Enid Chung-Raymer. She's a researcher at the Institute of Health and Productivity Studies at Johns Hopkins.
On-site clinics are 2 to 3 times more cost-effective than community-based care. If you calculate the time lost from work for an employee to be away to receive that care, that calculation comes to that 2 to 3 time difference in that productivity.
But cost isn't the only reason Eldorado Resorts, the parent company of Circus Circus, Silver Legacy, and Eldorado Casinos, decided to offer on-site medical care. Rick Murdoch is an executive with the El Dorado Resorts in Reno.
We decided that this just might give us an edge in the workplace for our employees and their dependents. So this is why we did it.
Murdoch declined to offer up specific numbers about how much it costs to set up the clinic or say how much it could save the company.
But I think the return is what we give back to our employees and helping us recruit. That's our return. I don't think this is a big money-making situation.
A survey from Mercer, a human resource consulting firm, shows about 30% of companies with 5,000-plus employees offer workplace clinics, and more are looking into launching these services.
Hey, I have a quick question.
Jacqueline Smith works in advertising for the Silver Legacy Casino. After an appointment at the clinic, she's back at her office. For Smith, having the clinic nearby is an added perk.
There are a lot of people out there that right now don't have insurance. They don't have medical coverage. So for an employer to provide that is a huge bonus for the employees. I think it provides a little less stress, gives them a little more comfort.
Smith says the addition of this new health service benefit would make her think twice about leaving her job. For Here and Now, I'm Ann Gray.
That's Laura Michelle Kelly in the touring production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's The King and I. Kelly won an Olivier Award, that's the British version of the Tony, for playing Mary Poppins in London, a role she then played on Broadway. She's also appeared on Broadway in Finding Neverland and Fiddler on the Roof. Earlier this year, we caught her in her current role playing Anna, an English governess who becomes a tutor to the wives and children of the King of Siam. Laura Michelle Kelly, welcome to Here and Now.
I love it here. This is a lovely studio if you're all at home listening.
Compared to your stage that you're on normally?
This is a fancy radio station compared to some others I have been into.
Okay, well, let's talk about that because, you know, you're somebody who is at the top of your craft. You've won the Olivier Award for playing Mary Poppins in London. You played it on Broadway. You were a star in Finding Neverland. And now you're touring.
Yeah. Why would I do that?
Why would you tour when you could be in one place?
Well, that's a really good question. I came out of doing New York thinking, you know, I need a new adventure. But when this show came up, I actually originally wanted to do the Lincoln Center production once Kelly O'Hara left. I was hoping they'd consider me. And I heard that they were in talks, but they rightly offered it to Marin Mazzi, the icon. And so I thought, oh, well, okay, that's that. But then they offered me the tour. So I thought, well, I don't really want to do a tour because I like my home comforts. And I know how hard it is from everyone's stories. And believe me, it is as hard as people say.
Are you living in hotels or what do you do?
No, I'm lucky enough to have to stay in a little Airbnbs all around the country because my beautiful little companion dog does not like hotels and they do not like him. So I'm actually boiling him a little and myself, and I'm doing it in apartments all around the nation, which isn't as easy as it sounds. But I love this show, and one of the reasons why I took King and I was because I wanted to work with Bartlett Sher, the most profound Tony Award winning director. And I was totally right because he's an incredible guy. And
what's so great about him?
He's a very, unlike some directors, he's a very encouraging director. So he brings out the best in you, but also challenges you. He's not like, you trust him to push your boundaries. And he certainly did that with this show. The character was very different from how I'd originally thought her to be. He's just such an instinctive guy. Like, he can tell the very minor details that a lot of people wouldn't notice.
Now, this is not the first time that you've actually played this character either, right?
No, I played it at the Muni at St. Louis, which was also an incredible experience. And I loved it. But I wasn't done with the part and I knew I'd like to play it again. And that's kind of ignited my passion. And I'm really glad there was so much more to it that we had time to, you know, explore.
What have you learned about the part this time around that you didn't know last time?
I think that the era that we're in with the political struggles we're having and the two different sides of the nation right now, that was definitely coming across in rehearsals. We've got two different cultures and divisions, and we're trying to bridge those cultures and communicate effectively you might be on two different sides. It's not easy to come together and help each other see each other's side. And that's exactly what Anna and the King are doing. She was brought in real life. This is a real life story. Anna Leon Owens in 1863, I believe, she got invited by the King of Siam to come in and modernize right. the country, help modernize the country. But not just that, to teach his children the ways of the world. And there's a lot of, struggles there because they have their myths and their legends and their ways. And she's saying this is wrong. They don't share the same values entirely. And you can't come at another person with saying, this my way is the only way and it's right. You've got to be very careful to come onto someone else's level and be like, okay, how can we work together? How can I help you see my side?
Well, we have gone entirely too far in this interview without hearing some of your voice, some of the singing. And of course, this show is so famous for the music, rightfully so. But maybe you can just give us a little bit of one of the songs.
One of my favorite songs in this show is Shall We Dance? And I'll sing just the introduction.
Yeah.
We've just been introduced. I do not know you well, but when the music started, something drew me to your side. So many men and girls are in each other's arms. It made me think we might be similarly occupied. Shall we dance on a bright cloud of music? Shall we fly? Shall we dance? Shall we then say good night and mean goodbye? Oh, perchance. And if you want to hear the rest, you have to watch the show.
You got to watch the show. But when I hear you do that, I just think, God, you were just made for this role.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Is it nice or annoying or what to sing it over and over and over again?
No, these songs by Rodgers and Hammerstein, they're incredible. And that's why they keep getting redone again and again and again. No, it's a pleasure to sing these every night. And I think they're a standard for the rest of for our generation to be like, we've got to make musicals as beautiful and as genius as them. And I think, you know, people like Lin-Manuel Miranda created Hamilton. It was breaking the mold and will last a lifetime and more. And that's exactly what they did. And it surpasses time or the years we're in, the era that we're in, because they're dealing with the human condition in all their words. And as I said, this was written in 1952. It was written about 1863. And we're sitting in 2017 and people still want to see it on stage every night. It's exquisite and genius. And heart-opening. And those are the kinds of productions that I want to be part of.
Now, I know that one of the things that's been difficult for you about this particular show is the dress that you have to wear, which weighs 40 pounds?
Yeah, 45. And it takes pounds. Four people to put it on, so three people now. But Kathy Zuber, she's won. There's no question why she won the Tony for Best Costume Design. The costumes we're all wearing are exquisite, this being one of them. And yes, it's £45, but it looks beautiful and it moves so well. It's so pretty to watch.
Now, I want to hear two pieces of sound here that we have from a different role that you played, Mary Poppins. You were Mary Poppins on Broadway and in London,
yes.
Right? And let's hear first the Mary Poppins that most Americans probably know, which would be Julie Andrews. This is from the 1964 movie.
And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see.
Okay, and then this is you from the London cast recording in 2005.
A robin feathering his nest has very little time to rest whilst gathering his bits of twine and twig.
Now, when you did that role, did you watch Julie Andrews or do you want to do things without, watching what other actresses do in those roles? Or what?
I love that you just did that, that you played both of those things. I think my voice has definitely been colored by Julie Andrews. I watched it every day of my youth on Sound of Music. And I met Julie Andrews. I was so nervous when she watched the show. My skirt fell off. And I had to sit down the whole scene because it was going to come off. I was mortified. I was more nervous about her coming to see me than the Queen when she came and saw me play Eliza in My Fair Lady. I was more nervous about Julie. She's my queen.
Well, what's the dream role for you? What do you want to do after The King and I?
That's a really good question. I would like to play all of them all over again. I would just really like to be really challenged, and I would really love to prevent some people going through the hard lessons that I have, if I could.
What do you mean the hard lessons?
Well, you know, there's times when you feel rejected or alone or, you know, we have to deal with on a daily basis the competition and being sold this fake version that we're supposed to try and be in the public eye, the being perfect, coming across perfect all the time. Like, it's just unreal.
Well, on the issue of rejection, that brings us back to where we started, which is when you have had the success that you have had, you still have to go out and audition.
Yeah, or you don't get the auditions because you're at a certain point and you can't. They just think they know what you're capable of now. I've always been terrible at auditions. Give me the material and I'll nail it, or give me the workshop and I'll be awesome. But don't ask me to be judged in front of a panel of 10 people staring at me forgetting the words.
I can't even imagine.
I've never been good at auditions, and I was just saying to the students, like, there's, you know, 101 ways to be great at audition process. I honestly, I've tried all these classes. I hate them. It's that feeling of judgment rather than giving to a crowd, and right. I can't get my head around it. I bomb every time. So luckily I've gained the reputation of that, not purposefully, just showing up and bombing. And they're like, trust us, she can be good.
Yeah, well, and somehow you managed to get these big roles anyway.
Somehow, it's a miracle.
That's Laura Michelle Kelly, who is currently starring in the touring production of The King and I. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here and to talk about King and I, which is one of my favorite shows of all time. So I'm grateful that people come to see it.
Our interview with Laura Michelle Kelly from last May, and you can still catch her in The King and I. For more information, go to hereandnow.org. The European green crab ranks among the world's worst invasive species, decimating populations of native clams, fish, and other crabs. The predators arrived in the U.S. from Europe in the 1800s and today cost the East Coast fishing industry $19 million a year. Now, green crabs are threatening commercial fisheries in California as well. KQED's Peter Arcuni reports on how ecologists in Marin County, California, are striking back.
On a single-seat kayak, Ian Pritchard of the University of California, Davis, Bodega Marine Lab, is catching hundreds of green crabs. The setting is Seadrift Lagoon, a small inlet north of San Francisco.
I just pulled up a trap. I see we have 5 crabs inside, and I'm just going to toss them in the bin.
The crabs Pritchard captures are small, most measuring less than 4 inches wide. Their shells are a mottled mix of green, gray, and red.
People around here tell stories about how they would walk into the lagoon or start swimming in the lagoon, and the crabs would be crawling over their feet and legs and things like that.
This is Kate Bimrose, who coordinates the Green Crab Project for the Greater Farallones Association. She takes inventory of Pritchard's haul, noting the size and sex of each one.
74, male. 64, female. And this one is actually gravid, so she's got eggs.
Bimrose says that in its lifetime, a single female crab can lay up to 1 million eggs. Over the summer, the team removed over 10,000 crabs from Seadrift Lagoon, which has the highest concentration of green crabs on the West Coast. And because it exchanges water with nearby Bolinas Lagoon, which connects to Pacific Ocean currents, the crabs here have potential to fuel a much larger invasion.
So you can imagine the type of population explosion that we could have if we let these guys run rampant.
European green crabs were first seen on the West Coast in San Francisco Bay in 1989. Researchers think baby crabs hitchhiked here in shipments of live fishing bait sent from the East Coast. By the time the Green Crab Project began removing crabs in 2009, there were an estimated 90,000 invasive crabs in the lagoon, At one point, the population spiked to over 300,000.
When we first started this project, there weren't much in the way of other species. Pretty much everything you got was all green crabs.
The number of green crabs in Seadrift Lagoon has since dropped to around 40,000. And here's the thing. Bimrose says that keeping enough of the larger adult crabs in the lagoon is key. The adults feed on the babies, keeping the population in check. Ted Grossholds, whose lab at UC Davis studies green crabs, says the removal project has been an important proving ground for invasive species management.
So now we have a strong recommendation for future efforts to control species like this.
While the team has started to see the return of native species to Seadrift, Grossholds says time will tell about the ecological and economic cost of the West Coast green crab invasion.
For us, it's kind of sit and wait and worry and hope that they don't reach the numbers that they reach on the East Coast.
If they do, the next step, Grossholds says, would be to release natural predators, like small sharks. For Here and Now, I'm Peter Arcuni.
Each week, we're joined on this show by Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. And today, for his last segment of 2017, he's going to tell us about some of the trends he's been noticing this year, trends you might have missed through all the headlines. Hi, Derek, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Jeremy. Thank you.
Well, and where would you start with trends of the last year?
Jeremy, if there was one word that I could use to summarize 2017, that word would be antitrust. And I mean that in two ways. First, antitrust, that is the lack of trust that the people now have toward institutions and politics and beyond, and the economic legal definition of antitrust, which is a fear of monopolies and an interest in breaking them apart. 2017 has seen extraordinary institutional distrust. Republicans control everything. They control the White House, the Senate, the Congress. They control a supermajority of governors' mansions and state legislatures. But they're publicly despised. The corporate tax reform that was just passed is one of the least popular tax bills in American history. Obamacare repeal and replace was one of the least popular bills in recent memory, and the party doesn't do very well in national polling. So you have institutional distrust toward the people who are in charge of government. You also have distrust within institutions. Democrats don't trust Republicans or vice versa. The White House doesn't trust Bob Mueller. Nobody seems to trust Donald Trump if you look at his presidential approval ratings. In economics, you have the rise of Bitcoin, which definitely is the story of the last 3 months. Bitcoin is a distributed currency built on a decentralized ledger called blockchain, which is essentially a thesis that fiat currency and centralized control of money is bad. So in many ways, you could say that the interest in Bitcoin and the rise in Bitcoin's valuation is all about institutional distrust itself. And then finally, you have the literal definition of antitrust. You have Donald Trump's Department of Justice going against AT&T and Time Warner's right. merger. You have the government scrutinizing maybe other mergers like Disney's attempt to combine with Fox. And you have a new enthusiasm, I think, even on the left about antitrust as a central governing principle of liberalism in this country. So just top to bottom, I think this theme of trust is central to 2017 and particularly the lack of it.
Well, and there's also a lack of trust by many for the tech companies, whether it be Facebook or Google or Twitter. They have gotten themselves into trouble in the last year, especially because of what happened with Russian hacking in the election. How do you think Americans are feeling about the big tech companies overall in 2017?
Within media, I've definitely seen a shift in the way that we report on companies like Facebook or Twitter or Tesla. I think in many ways, you know, one way that I think that Marc Andreessen summarized it, a big Silicon Valley investor, he said the narrative has shifted from tech is stupid to tech is evil. That for a long time, the focus was on how Facebook was frivolous, on how Twitter wasn't making any money, on how Tesla was silly. And now it's tech is evil. Facebook is evil. Twitter is evil. Netflix is a monopoly. Google makes too much money. I think that narrative is actually shifting into a third degree, and that is tech is so big that it justifies any merger. CVS and Aetna, they've said that they have to merge to counter Amazon's potential foray into pharmaceuticals. Disney and Fox have said that their potential merger is essentially all about combating Netflix. AT&T and Time Warner, one of the big media mergers that the government is now going up against, have said this is all about competing with Netflix and Facebook and Google across the board. I think you're going to see this in 2018, too, quite honestly, to make a little bit of a prediction. I think you're going to see mergers running rampant across the economy, A, because of the corporate tax reform bill that are going to make these mergers more attractive, but B, because you now have these tech behemoths whose shadow extends all across the economy, and these legacy companies saying the only way that we can compete is for us to band together and merge. And so I think this is a narrative you're going to see a lot or hear a lot in the next year. Tech is so big that it justifies anything.
Now, the scary part of that, if 2018 is a big year for mergers, is that the experts do say that all the mergers and acquisitions happen right before the crash. So we've had a very strong year economically in the last year. The stock market at record levels. A lot of people's 401ks probably up 20 or 25% in the last year. What do you make of how the economy is doing right now? And will we ever see a year like this again?
It's really been a remarkable year for the economy. I mean, I've been coming on this show for a while, and I think that for many years, you and I have talked about how poorly the economy is doing, how disappointing it is. I think I should point out that 2017 has been a really remarkable year. I mean, from top to bottom, the Dow was set an all-time high 70 times. That's once every 5 days.
Yeah.
A lot of people can say, well, you know, that's good for people with 401ks. It's good for investors. But actually, 80% of corporate stock is owned by the richest 10% of the country. So, you know, does that really trickle down? Well, you know, at the same time, unemployment now is nearing an all-century low. It's near 4%, and it could, you know, fall into the mid-threes, honestly, within the next few months. Manufacturing confidence is higher than ever. Confidence among home builders in the construction industry is at an all-century high. Earlier this year, I was talking about fears that legacy retail companies were really taking a hit as Amazon was growing. But holiday sales are now projected to hit their highest levels in 3 years at malls and traditional retail outlets. From top to bottom, you really see just remarkable strength across the economy. And of course, we should focus on the distribution of this growth. Is it growing as much at the bottom as it is at the top? But here again, there's actually some evidence that wages have been growing fastest in the last 18 months at the bottom rather than the middle or the top. So truly, just about anywhere you look in the economy right now in the last 12 months, it seems to be doing pretty well.
Now, there's one stock that I have noticed is not doing very well, and it had been doing very well, and that is Chipotle, the Mexican fast casual chain. We were talking a couple of years ago about how people were looking for Taco Bell prices, but Chili's level of what they were getting, and that seemed to be a really good model for them. What happened with a company like Chipotle?
I think two things. The first is that they had that health scare a few years ago, and that's a huge bummer for any company, but it's particularly a bummer if you're working in a crowded sector that has lots of fresh choices. And fast casual, which is the sector that places like Chipotle and Panera and Cozy kind of inaugurated, has just blown up in the last 2 years, in a good way, positive blown up. Fast casual's totally on fire. I wrote a piece earlier this year on the renaissance of the restaurant industry that you've seen across the country. And it did seem to me anecdotally, when I was going into reporting the piece, that wherever I went, D.C., New York, Boston, Portland, Seattle, everyone said they were having a restaurant renaissance. And indeed, the number of individual restaurants has exploded in fast casual. Total locations have soared by 9% in the last year. But there's actually just too many of them now, so that same-store sales are actually falling by more than 2% annually. Hmm. So essentially what's happening is that people are eating more at places like Chipotle, but they're eating at the new Chipotles or the new Panera or the new Cozy, which means that Chipotle, Panera, and Cozy, the people that sort of inaugurated this, are all struggling a lot. And they're not keeping up with places like, say, you know, Sweetgreen, which is a salad place that is just, at least anecdotally to me, popping up everywhere and started in the D.C. area and now is just ubiquitous in New York. So I think that fast casual has grown a lot as a sector, but now it's kind of like television, where we're in a golden age of television, but there's so many different TV shows that no one show is having like, MASH ratings, right? Where like 40% of America is tuning into the right. same show every week. The exact same thing is happening in fast casual.
All right. Well, we just have about a minute left, Derek, but any other trends you're watching from the last year?
So I just came across this stat this morning, actually. 2017 is within striking distance of being the best year for job creation at bars that we've ever seen. The BLS has been tracking job creation at bars, taverns, and nightclubs for the last few years. And this could set the 30-year record for the most jobs created at these drinking institutions. So in terms of why, well, you know, to oversimplify, there's two reasons why people go out to bars. They're really happy, they want to celebrate, or they're anxious and they want to take it out on a whiskey. And so on the one hand, you know, you could say this has been a record year for the economy in many ways. On the other hand, I think that for a lot of people in this country, it's been a stressful year, an anxious year. And so maybe they've wanted to gather their friends and, you know, curl an elbow and have a beer. So maybe for both of these reasons coming together, we are now looking at what could be a record year for job creation at bars in 2017.
All right. Well, I think that we've both earned a drink, Derek. So we'll leave it right there. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you and happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Enjoy that eggnog.
Remember the biosphere, the giant terrarium that a group of people built and moved into back in the 90s to do research and more fully understand how ecosystems work? It was actually called Biosphere 2 because the Earth is the original biosphere. Jonathan Hirsch from KUOW's environment podcast Terrestrial has the story now about the origins of the experiment and the role a guy named Steve Bannon, yes, that Steve Bannon, played in its demise.
The biosphere sits in Oracle, Arizona, just outside of Tucson. Laser Vantillo is a mechanical engineer, and he was there for the construction in 1987.
So it was a hustle and bustle of people creating a new world.
A new world its creators thought should contain a bit of the whole world, literally. Ocean, farmland, savanna, rainforest. But underneath this new planet, instead of dirt, there was a laboratory outfitted with sensors to measure everything up above. Nitrogen levels in the soil, oxygen levels in the atmosphere. The person who first came up with the idea was this guy named John Allen. He had a bunch of projects, starting back in the 60s. A theater troupe, collective farm, a ship that sailed all over the globe. And then, the biosphere. Vantillo met Allen while he was sailing around the globe and decided to join the team.
So to me, it was adventure. I was really into exploration as well as the ecology.
By 1991, the Biosphere Project was a joint venture between Allen's team and Texas billionaire Edward Bass and had raised tens of millions of dollars. And in March of that year, eight crew members embarked on their first mission, 2 years sealed inside the 3-acre dome of the biosphere. Along with Laser Vantillo, Gay Alling was part of the crew. She says there were lots of challenges, food, water, oxygen levels. But at the end of the first 2-year mission, the crew members still felt that the problems inside the biosphere could help fix the problems outside, on Earth.
If we had known all about our biosphere, building Biosphere 2 would have been really easy. We didn't know, and we didn't know as we walked in the door how a biosphere works. We still don't really know.
Then it came time for the second mission. Pascal Maslin was a crew member, and she says that from the start, there was increasing pressure to show the biosphere was a success. And just 4 weeks into the mission, the crew received a video call. It was the two consultants Bass had recently hired to audit the biosphere budget, Martin Bowen, who'd been hired to manage Bass's money, and another consultant, a guy named Steve Bannon.
We got called into mission control, and there was this V-shaped table with a camera on us and a big television screen. And so we were sitting there in front of Martin Bowen and Steve Bannon and everybody, saying that they had taken over the biosphere and the old management team had been removed.
Yeah, Steve Bannon. The same Steve Bannon who would later run Breitbart News and serve as an advisor to President Donald Trump. According to the project's main backer, Ed Bass, the biospherians were chronically over budget, and the kinds of innovations that would make the biosphere a good investment, they weren't happening fast enough. So he brought on Bowen and Bannon. But the old management wasn't ready to give up. Pascal says Gay, Laser, and John Allen were in Japan when all this happened. In John Allen's memoir, he describes collapsing to the ground in tears of grief when he heard the news. As for Gay and Laser, they got on a plane to Arizona and arrived shortly after the takeover. They hiked through the desert, using back roads to get to the biosphere.
And then they came into the biosphere, they opened all the doors, and then the lungs are set up.
The lungs were a mechanized system that controlled air pressure. But the lungs were also fitted with a hammer on a chain that could break a small piece of glass from the dome, which would halt the experiment. Basically, it was a big stop button.
So Laser went in there and pulled that chain and broke the glass. So he ended the experiment, is what happened.
Everyone I spoke to for this story was hesitant to talk about Steve Bannon's involvement in the project. But Pascal did comment on where Bannon ended up years later, going from managing the biosphere to playing a critical role in the first year of the Trump presidency.
He's a master of hostile takeovers, isn't he? And, you know, at least at the beginning of this administration, it looked like he was orchestrating it.
Bannon, of course, is no longer a part of the Trump administration. Shortly after leaving, however, he told Bloomberg News that he was, quote, going to war for Trump against his opponents on Capitol Hill, in the media, and in corporate America, end quote. And again, just to be clear, Bannon was brought on as the interim CEO of the biosphere by Ed Bass. As for the biosphere, after several more months, the second mission was terminated. Eventually, the facility was sold to Columbia University, who later sold it to the University of Arizona. It's since been open to the public. However, no researchers live inside. For Here and Now, I'm Jonathan Hirsch.